Today is Monday, December 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Negotiators meet again as they try to hammer out a Brexit deal for the year's end. But
significant differences remain on the three critical issues: level playing field, governance, and fisheries.
Plus, the potential impact of repositioning U.S. troops from Somalia.
Deciding to pull 700 troops out of Somalia right now is not helpful on the counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, or general stabilization.
And using virtual reality to foster empathy. We'll have these stories and more next. Post-Brexit trade talks are hanging in the balance Monday as Britain and the European Union make a last-ditch attempt to bridge significant differences and reach a deal that would avoid a disorderly exit just 24 days away. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says that there is still some ways to go before the deal could be sealed.
Significant differences remain on the three critical issues: level playing field, governance, and fisheries. Both sides underline that no agreement is feasible if these issues are not solved.
And in London, resident Paul White expressed his frustration.
It seems crazy. I mean, 2016, we voted, and 4 years later, and I don't think they've made much progress at all, to be honest with you. Personally, I think no deal is probably better than a bad deal, which is what Theresa May has said all along. But who knows what's going to happen? I don't think even they know, to be honest with you.
Now, to get a better idea of just where things currently stand in the talks, I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris via WhatsApp.
First of all, what you're hearing a lot of is that this deal is 95% done. That 95% were the easy bits. They were the bits they could agree on. What they cannot agree on now are access. That means anything which the UK wants to send to Europe has to meet all the standards of the EU single market. The UK says, well, we're a sovereign nation. We shouldn't be held to EU standards. We have our own standards. After that, the EU has said, OK, well, if there's any type of dispute, we want some sort of mechanism by which we could go and hammer out a dispute, to which the UK has said, no, you know, we don't want any formal mechanism. We know one another. We've been trading with one another for long enough. We don't want that sort of official mechanism. And we most certainly do not want the EU's favourite, which is the European Court of Justice, to adjudicate on this. On top of that, you have this thing which calls level playing field. Now, that is fair competition. And what the EU is saying is, we want to safeguard against any type of sweetheart deal whereby the UK government pours tax money into a company, gives it an unfair advantage, dumps its products into Europe, and therefore Europe's manufacturers and traders are disadvantaged. The UK says, well, that's up to us. We're a sovereign nation. We can do that. So really, it's just that absolutely simple thing of trade disputes, fair competition, and how you can safeguard.
Now, Catherine, we heard from Paul White over in London that they voted on this in 2016, and this is really coming down to the wire. So what do we know about the discussions that are slated to take place this week and key decisions?
Well, all I can tell you is what the chief negotiator for the EU told representatives of the 27 member nations this morning was the mood is gloomy, it is downbeat. We're going to try and keep talking until Wednesday, and hopefully something will come up. The Irish Foreign Minister has said talks are stalled, but they will still keep talking. We've got that crucial Monday evening in Brussels phone call between the President of the Commission and the UK Prime Minister. Then we have that day, Wednesday, they've now said it's all got to be either done or fall apart on Wednesday. Then you have Thursday, a European Union summit where all of the leaders get together in person. This will not be a virtual meeting, in person. Then those leaders, the 27 leaders, will outline whether there's been a failure to create a post-Brexit trade deal with the United Kingdom, or if there's room for manoeuvre after that. But certainly, if there are no more talks, no more chances of any agreement, then the leaders will decide on Thursday in Brussels to put in place contingency for a no-deal Brexit on January 1st.
Catherine Field reports from Paris, France. The United States is pulling out hundreds of troops deployed to Somalia to battle the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, even as military commanders admit that the threat from the Al-Qaeda-linked group has not been eliminated. Africa Command spokesman Colonel Chris Carnes told VOA, quote, a threat remains, but he added, it is contained via continued pressure on the network, end quote. The White House says a limited number of troops will remain in Somalia and that the remaining number will be positioned on the continent. Judd Davermont is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and I began our conversation by asking him what the impact repositioning the troops may be.
To start off with, I think this decision is reckless and poorly timed. Somalia is about to have an election. We're seeing troops pulled from the Ethiopia contingents, and deciding to pull 700 troops out of Somalia right now is not helpful on the counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, or general stabilization. What's important to reflect upon is that it is probably likely that they're going to still be able to do drone strikes from Djibouti, for example. But what those 700 troops were doing that are so critical is training the Somali forces so they can stand on their own. So we might be able to continue to do strikes if there's an imminent threat, but we're not positioning the Somali forces ever to stand on their own if we're not going to have our troops in country working side by side with Somali partners.
So what does that do in terms of creating a security environment if that training isn't able to take place?
So Shabaab has lost a lot of key territory over the past, 5 to 7 years, but they're still very active in the rural areas, and they're still quite effective to operate within Mogadishu. They're unlikely, or they rarely have hit U.S. targets, but they do hit significant population centers within Mogadishu. And without the U.S. sponsorship and mentorship of key units, particularly the Dinab network, I don't think that we'll see major gains on the Somali forces to continue to push Shabaab out of Mogadishu or out of the rural areas.
So what needs to be done to, continue to address the threat of Al-Shabaab? Because the United States has said that, it's a degraded network. There's pressure being applied and the threat is contained.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that the United States should be doing in partnership with other countries and regional forces. So there currently is a large African Union deployment there. It's probably looking at some of the functions of that African Union mission to see what it could do in addition to clearing and holding territory. The U.S. could probably do some of the training of the Somali forces outside of Somalia, or at least come in for brief stints. But this is a great time to have a real look at what we're doing in Somalia, to make sure that we're right sized, that we're focused on some strategic goals. I would have never suggested or recommended to pull 700 troops as quickly and swiftly as the Trump administration is doing. But as we transition from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, it's really important to go back to basics here. What are we trying to do in terms of working with our Somali partners to address the security environment? And then what is the right amount of U.S. personnel and partner forces to achieve those goals?
Judd Davermont is the CSIS Africa Program Director. The world has more than 67.1 million COVID-19 cases, attributing to more than 1.5 million deaths. The United States leads the world in both categories with 14.7 million total cases and just over 282,000 deaths, according to statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University. The Pfizer BioNTech vaccine against the coronavirus must be stored at extremely cold temperatures, raising some concerns about the difficult task of moving it across the United States for inoculations. But the dry ice companies across the U.S. say that they are up to the challenge. Issa Shirai spoke with one such company in Baltimore, Maryland.
As the U.S. moves to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine against the coronavirus, a big challenge will be keeping the vaccine cold.
It's got to be kept between not minus 70 and minus 90, which the dry ice can do.
But this dry ice maker in Baltimore, with decades of experience and five warehouse employees, says it won't be competing for business.
This is going to be a national deal. I don't believe there's any one dry ice company that can take care of all that.
Most companies like Capital Carbonic are already producing the specific size and shape of ice. Pfizer, and likely other vaccine companies, would require the ice to come in a pellet smaller than the standard 5/8 size.
It's a lot. It'll fit down in the boxes a lot more than a regular 5/8 standard pellet. This is for a lot of biomedical researchers that use this.
Although the task seems daunting, Weldon says that having worked with the National Institute of Health for years, his company is up to the challenge.
We're ready. I mean, our tanks are full. You know, I mean, we're capable of running 7 days a week.
And Capital Carbonic does expect that once distribution starts, dry ice production will be a 24/7 job. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Baltimore.
Britain is also on the eve of launching a COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Staffers with the nation's National Health Service, nursing home residents, and their caregivers on Tuesday will begin to receive the first of two doses of a vaccine jointly developed by U.S.-based pharmaceutical giant Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech. The initiative will start nearly a week after the government's medical regulatory agency granted emergency approval for the vaccine, making Britain the first Western nation ready to begin mass inoculations. In addition, British news outlets reported on Sunday that 94-year-old Queen Elizabeth II and her 99-year-old husband Prince Philip will announce when they are to receive the vaccine, hoping to reassure the British public of its safety. Indonesian President Joko Widodo announced on Sunday the country has received a shipment of a coronavirus vaccine developed by China's Sinovac biotechnology company. The vaccine is still undergoing testing in Indonesia, where the government is making final preparations for an initiative to inoculate as many as 270 million people. Still to come.
Some would treat her like a child, and she would sense that, and you know, she would kind of push back and say, I don't want to be talked down to like I'm a child.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have been trying to locate a mysterious source of gamma rays since they were first detected in 1999. A team of scientists led by the Max Planck Institute for Gravitational Physics say they have located an odd binary system that's made up of a neutron star with a mass twice that of our sun and a companion star with about 1% the mass of our sun. The team found that the two stars orbit each other once every 75 minutes. They determined the neutron star is a pulsar that rotates at 33,000 revolutions per minute and sends a pulse of gamma rays once every 2,000th of a second. The team made their discovery with a unique computing network that connects the computers of volunteers around the world. This computing system allowed the team to analyze data gathered by NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Republicans and Democrats are working to get Georgia residents to vote in the January 5th runoff election that will decide the control of the U.S. Senate. But Republicans remain divided about the results of the November 3rd presidential race, with U.S. President Donald Trump still asserting widespread voter fraud claims. Michelle Quinn takes things from here.
Pressure is building in the southern U.S. state of Georgia as Democrats and Republicans encourage people to start voting as early as December 14 in two runoff races. The outcome of the election set for January 5th will determine which political party will be in the majority in the U.S. Senate.
The stake in this election is control of the U.S. Senate, and that really means control of this country.
Former President Barack Obama.
The special election in Georgia is going to determine, ultimately, the course of the Biden presidency and whether Joe Biden and Kamala Harris can deliver legislatively all the commitments they've made.
For Republicans, there are mixed feelings about the integrity of the state's voting system after Democrat and former Vice President Joe Biden won the state by about 12,000 votes. President Donald Trump has called on Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, to ask the state legislature to overturn the election results and order an audit of mail ballot signatures. Still at a rally in the state over the weekend, Trump, who has refused to concede, encouraged people to start voting.
You must go vote and vote early starting December 14th. You have to do it. They cheated and they rigged our presidential election, but we will still win it.
That mixed message is making it hard for some state leaders, many of whom are Republican, like Kemp. Another is Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who oversees the state's election system.
The job of the Republican Party is to raise money and turn out the vote. My job as Secretary of State is to make sure we have honest and fair elections. It's as simple as that. And I think in my office, integrity matters.
The misinformation around the presidential election results is complicating efforts among Republicans to get out the vote, Raffensperger said.
What makes it, these distractions, this disunity, it does make it more difficult. And so the candidates are out there running hard.
In the coming weeks, all eyes will be on the Peach State as both Democrats and Republicans work to get out the vote. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Voting is underway Monday in the West African nation of Ghana, where ballots are being cast for president and members of the 275-seat legislature. Although 12 candidates are seeking the presidency, the race is being viewed as a two-way contest between incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriot Party and former President John Mahama, the leader of the opposition National Democratic Congress Party. This is a third contest between the two men since 2012, when Mahama defeated Akufo-Addo, followed by Akufo-Addo's win in 2016. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is denying that a rebellious northern force his troops have battled for over a month would have the capacity to mount a guerrilla war from the mountains of Tigray. Federal troops have captured the regional capital from the former local ruling party and declared an end to their offensive. But the Tigray People's Liberation Front leaders say that they are fighting back on various fronts around Mekelle. Ethiopian experts are fearful of a drawn-out insurgency with a destabilizing impact around East Africa. Social media in Cameroon is highlighting political and ethnic tensions unleashed by the disputed 2018 presidential election. That's according to a new report by the International Crisis Group. The ICG says that social media platforms, especially Facebook, should better filter toxic content and promote verified pages to reduce the tensions. Moki Edwin Kinzika has that story.
The International Crisis Group report says Cameroon is already facing serious security challenges and should find a way to ease political tensions and stop offensive language, such as ethnic slurs that are causing the Central African state to sink into violence. Are Elvis Ntui, the ICG's senior analyst for Cameroon, says hate speech and inter-ethnic tensions have increased since the October 2018 presidential elections. He says the hate speech problem could endanger Cameroon's stability.
This period has been marked by lots of street protests. The country is currently dealing with a separatist insurgency in its Anglophone regions. Also, the army is dealing with Boko Haram insurgency in the far north of the country with nearly daily attacks. Cameroon cannot simply afford to allow the ethnic and political tensions it's currently facing to rise to levels where they could constitute intercommunity violence.
President Paul Biya, who has been in power for 38 years, was declared winner of the elections. His victory is still contested by opposition leader Maurice Kamto, who insists he, not Biya, was the winner. Are says Cameroon can avoid a slide into instability by reforming its electoral system.
Crisis Group proposes that Cameroon strengthen its institutions, which are responsible for addressing discrimination and improving its policy of living together. Some of these include discussing with the extra-parliamentary opposition in order to review the electoral system to make it more fairer and more acceptable.
Are says the ruling CPDM party and the opposition should take measures to address the excesses of their supporters on social media, especially Facebook. He adds Facebook should also help to check inflammatory language, provocative content, and fake news, which he says contribute to inflaming the ethnic and political tension. Government spokesperson Rene Emmanuel Sadi says there is growing hate speech through social media. He blames opposition parties that he says want to weaken Biya's rule.
The government of the Republic appeals to the majority of the Cameroonian people who have never allowed themselves to be misguided by unscrupulous politicians. The government, through my voice, exhorts Cameroonian men and women at home and abroad to thwart destabilizing maneuvers wherever they come from.
Thursday's report comes at a time when NGOs and journalism groups in Cameroon are warning against the use of media organs to propagate hate speech. Rose Oba, the national coordinator of the Cameroon Community Media Network, says journalists should not be used as propaganda tools.
If you even have an interview where you have attributes of like name labeling that may incite violence, we just come in to advise our members of the Cameroon Community Media Network as well as other journalists to be the first persons to do some kind of censorship around hate speech and fake news. Such words are unhealthy. Such words just come in to incite more violence. And definitely with our main tool, peace journalism, we use it to encourage reporters and editors to encourage a peaceful society.
The International Crisis Group says President Biya should be wary of leaving behind a country riven with fighting and separatist sentiment in Anglophone areas, but also by wider tensions endangering Cameroon's relatively amicable inter-ethnic relations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The number of people aged 65 or older is growing faster around the world than any other age group, according to the United Nations. Elizabeth Lee reports virtual reality is now being used to help caregivers develop more understanding and empathy.
Emma,
who is that?
Imagine having Alzheimer's disease or having a hard time seeing and hearing. These age-related health challenges can now be experienced through virtual reality or VR.
It's part of our own future of aging. So if we can see ourselves in older people that might have these slight changes, just a matter of patience and knowledge could help reduce the stress and stigma of that disease.
Carrie Shaw founded Embodied Labs, a company that immerses a user into the world of the elderly to better understand their reality. The experiences include hearing the confusion related to memory loss from Alzheimer's.
What was I looking for?
To visual impairment. Shaw's mother suffered from Alzheimer's disease. She realized even professional caregivers found it challenging interacting with her mother.
Some would treat her like a child, and she would sense that. And you know, she would kind of push back and say, I don't want to be talked down to like I'm a child.
The company offers the software and hardware needed for the VR experience to help users develop empathy.
Today we use a live-action film that's also blended into a game engine so it becomes interactive.
Jamie Hannons uses Embodied Labs to train nursing students. She says this VR experience with macular degeneration opened her eyes.
When you're in the headset, looking kind of to the side to view what's going on, I saw that tilt and I thought, I've seen that with patients so many times, and not recognized it as an opportunity to say, how's your vision?
For now, Embodied Labs only sells to services for the aging because Shaw says it's important that VR is paired with a guided discussion and reflection.
I am your brain.
To process what the users experienced so they know how to put into action what they've learned. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
I know all this may sound scary, but we're with you every step of the way.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.